Then there's the GEPF, that disruption of service bill, otherwise known as the Kellerman bill, which we have to... It's the ghost bill. Then we also have this special appropriation for ESCOM to deal with. So there are all of those. I wanted to apologize for the DG, but he was busy on a radio interview. It's not for any other reason, so, but he's here. And I also want to apologize for the Deputy Minister, Chair. if you'll advise on...
Apology accepted.
Thank you. You're so
but
kind.
Yeah, maybe let's just... my view is that it would not be difficult to deal with all of them. But we will take them one at a time. We will first take your statement on the if there are internships, take questions on that, and then proceed to the adjustments as the next. And then
Chair, let me ask DDG, responsible budget office, Mr. Naidu, to do the presentation that's before us here. And you know, I'll go and sit in the cross benches again from now.
First name, Kumban.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Yesterday, the Minister tabled a medium-term budget policy statement. I'm going to do a short presentation that runs through some of the main highlights of the document, and members have read the document, so I won't go into detail unless requested to do so. The first point that we'd like to make is that the global economic context has changed considerably since the 2008 budget was tabled. While the present global financial crisis was not unexpected, the environment is certainly very different. And to use the minister's word, the ferocity of the storm is certainly greater than we anticipated. I think the main point or theme of the medium-term budget policy statement is that South Africa will weather the storm. While we might see slightly slower growth, we've got the wherewithal to weather the storm because of some of the early policy decisions on fiscal policy, on inflation targeting, on a gradual approach to the relaxation of exchange controls, decisions on banking regulation, on public spending choices, etc. Those strengths will allow us to weather the storm. The economy in South Africa is likely to slow. We're projecting slower growth this year than budgeted, and even slower growth next year before we think that the economy is likely to recover in 2010 and beyond. That has certain implications that we'll go into in detail. The budget framework is able to cushion the economy, or at least partially cushion the economy against the slowdown through continuing to spend on infrastructure, and in fact even increasing the spending on infrastructure, the continuation of the expansion of public services, and significant additional resources into programs that target the poor, in particular school nutrition, social grants, agricultural support, and so forth. The key budget priorities include the quality of education, transforming the health sector, enhancing citizen safety and reducing the crime levels, rural development, and expanding infrastructure in the built environment, particularly to meet our universal service objectives of access to housing, water, sanitation, etc. there's a series of cross-cutting themes in the budget priorities to do with employment creation, and in particular the introduction of the rollout of phase two of the expanded public works program, protecting the environment and reducing our carbon emissions, and then more generally improving the capacity of the state, the effectiveness of the civil service and its institutions. This slide highlights our macroeconomic forecasts. The three or four most critical items is, firstly, we expect after a long run of growth above 6-7% in household consumption, we expect household consumption growth to fall quite sharply to 1.6% next year before recovering. But even then, it's likely to underperform GDP growth overall. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It allows for a rebalancing of the economy, and that rebalancing is taken up by the fact that gross fixed capital formation continues to grow at close to 10% over the period, and that will be one of the key drivers of growth over the next 3 years, both public and private sector investment. Our GDP growth forecast, we budgeted on the basis of 4% GDP growth in 2008. We've revised that down to 3.7%, and we've revised next year's GDP growth forecast down to 3% before we think that the economy is likely to recover towards the end of 2009, early 2010. Inflation has increased throughout 2008. I'll go into that in a little bit more detail in a moment, but we think that inflation is likely to fall back within the target range towards in the third quarter of 2009, and will average about 6.2% for calendar year 2009. The current account deficit is still projected to remain high despite the slower growth, mainly because of the import-intensive infrastructure projects that the country has to deliver. Serena? Thanks. Mr. Chair, this graph here has got a series of lines and some bars. The bars are global growth, and that middle line, the red line, is South Africa's growth. I think it's important that members understand that very close correlation between global economic growth and South Africa's GDP growth. The line at the top is emerging economies such as India and China, and the line at the bottom is developed countries, G7 growth. But our fortunes are in some ways linked to that of the global economy, and this graph illustrates that quite significantly. Global growth is likely to slow to 3% next year, and growth in the G7 countries is likely to reach zero next year, with several of those countries actually budgeting for negative growth. Lisetje was telling us a story yesterday about how the Germans were quite optimistic and proud that their GDP forecast for next year is high at 0.2%. It's a sign of significant stresses in the global economy, mainly precipitated by a financial crisis. It has now spread to the real economy, mainly because of the fact that it's more difficult to get financing for various activities, ranging from housing to business, etc. Our GDP revisions are mainly driven by slower global growth, by falling commodity prices, but there's also capacity constraints within the domestic economy that impact on our growth. Overall, we think South Africa's growth is relatively strong relative to the rest of the world. Strong fixed capital formation is likely to drive growth. We're quite optimistic that we've seen the top of food prices, and food prices will at least start moderating, and oil prices have started coming down. We've seen improved agricultural output, and a more competitive exchange rate provides an additional stimulus during this period of global turbulence. And so we're relatively optimistic about our growth forecast, despite the fact that there's a downward revision. We're not in a bad shape relative to most of the developed and even large emerging markets. This is just a reflection of the investment drive The blue bars being general government, the grey bars public corporations. Over the next 2 years, while the private sector is still responsible for 72% of all fixed investment in the country, over the next 2 years, growth in public corporation, investment by public corporations is likely to add up to 1.5% of GDP, growth to the GDP rate. Unfortunately, in your paper copy, this is not very clear, but it's just a reflection that food and fuel were the single or the two factors that drove higher inflation. Fuel prices have started moderating, and so have food prices. And that is why we're fairly optimistic that inflation is likely to fall next year. The medium-term budget policy statement also introduces a series of policy areas, or doesn't introduce, but raises a series of policy areas on how we need to sustain growth during this period of slower global growth. But more importantly, what is it going to take for us to increase our GDP growth? What is it going to take for us to get a more inclusive growth path? And the statement reflects a number of areas: trade policy, industrial policy, the effectiveness of the labor market regime, effectiveness of competition policy, public investment, and the financing of public investment are all likely to require further attention. Often the policy stance is there, but the implementation of the policies have not always kept pace with what has been expected. So as a result, we need to spend the next 2 or 3 years focusing on how, when the storm ends, our economy is more competitive and more inclusive. Inclusive growth essentially means raising the level of employment, so that there's a broader sharing of the opportunities. Going into some of the specifics, in the 2008 budget, we budgeted for a higher tax-to-GDP ratio and a slight increase in the tax-to-GDP ratio. Our tax-to-GDP ratio is likely to be lower than at the time of the budget, even though our gross tax revenue number is unchanged. We're also forecasting that revenue growth would slow in the next 3 years. While personal income taxes are slightly higher than budgeted, customs duties, transfer duties, and even value-added taxes under some pressure because of slowing consumption and house sales. The key reforms that were announced this year that will be discussed in detail in the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill, the conversion of the STC into a dividend tax at shareholder level, the tax incentives to support industrial development, low-cost housing, urban renewal, and the SMME incentives will all be discussed in the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. There's also been a simplification of the taxation of lump sum withdrawals on retirement funds, and significant changes to the taxation of very small businesses with a turnover of less than 1 million rand. On the expenditure side, we continue to see strong real growth in public spending, although slightly slower than over the previous 3 or 4 years. Over the previous 3 or 4 years, public spending growth averaged 9%. That's likely to fall to 5 or 6% over the next 3 years. Even excluding ESCOM, there's significant real growth in public spending over the next 3 years. This graph reflects the pattern of public spending growth over the past 13 years or so, and includes the budget projections, the fiscal framework or the budget framework projections. Education remains the largest area of public spending. This is in real terms, so this is after taking account of the impact of inflation. In the period 2001 to 2004, Social Security spending was the fastest growing area of spending. But since 2004, investment in the built environment, housing, water, sanitation, roads, have been the fastest growing area of investment. But all those major five sectors see strong real growth in public spending. this is just a breakdown of the additional resources over the next 3 years. You can see more than half of that goes to social security, health and education, but there's significant adjustments for economic services and the criminal justice sector as well. I just want to highlight some of the in-year adjustments, even though there will be a detailed presentation on the adjustments budget. The spending level is projected to rise from budgeted 611 billion to 635 billion. The main changes are 7.7 billion in inflation-related adjustments, of which about 5 of that is personnel-related. 2 billion rand for items dealing with natural disasters. 1.4 billion rand for stadiums and 600 million rand for last mile access, network access, the stadiums that cost overrun. 2.5 billion rand provision to take account of the recommendations of the Maseneke Commission. The cost overrun in the nursing occupation specific dispensation receives additional resources, and the road accident fund gets a cash injection of 2.5 billion rand. There's also significant or a provision for 500 million rand for social relief of distress. The Department of Social Development has been making greater use of this grant in response to higher food prices. The major transfers to provinces include adjustments for inflation, 51.3 billion rand extra over the next 3 years. The main priorities there in education is no-fee schooling, lowering the pupil-teacher ratio, increasing investment in school infrastructure, in particular grade R, and for the introduction of 3 new vaccines. The provincial government is also in health, additional resources provide for TB track and trace teams, and reducing child mortality and maternal mortality. Social development also receives additional resources. The school nutrition program is one of the largest recipients of the additional spending in this year's budget framework. Over 4 billion rand extra given to the school nutrition program. Municipalities receive an additional 8.8 billion, of which about 3 billion is to compensate them for the more expensive cost of delivering free basic services, and the remaining amounts goes to infrastructure, 4.3 billion rand extra for the municipal infrastructure grant, both to compensate for higher construction inflation, but also to expand access to water, sanitation, and electricity. I've mentioned the stadiums, the stadium amounts, there's some amounts in next year as well, and for public transport related to the World Cup. There's also significant increases in investment in bulk regional infrastructure in both water and electricity. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, I think the budget framework takes account of the more difficult global environment. The period ahead will see slower growth, but the fiscal position is healthy enough to be able to accommodate this environment. Public investment and the expansion of public services will continue, but we've got to focus on raising the long-term growth potential, and that requires sound macroeconomic policies, continued investment in public services, but better implementation on the microeconomic policy side in order to try and get a more labor-intensive growth trajectory. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, they cannot.
I believe alternatives of time are going to take the MCPS together with that time. And we'll never block our questions on those, because the question of members move that much. So we just locate this on a good kind of people in our especially on your environment, the minister to speak, you just have to go over to what the system. Until such time that they have something to see, we have a lot of stuff. It's really very frustrating because it's not like we woke up this morning and decided to read the event. The president has a book that says no, that we read the book again. And I think for us, who's going to do the next presentation on the other why don't you let us sit there?
Me too, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The adjustments appropriation bill is accompanied by the adjusted estimates of national expenditure, which provides a detailed breakdown of all the changes in the appropriation bill for each national department. Section 30-2 of the PFMA spells out six areas or reasons for adjustments to the budget. They include economic circumstances or changed economic circumstances, unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, expenditure in terms of Section 16, which is an emergency provision, and this year we've made use of Section 16, and I'll go into some detail on that. Expenditure that's been announced by the Minister of Finance in the budget speech but not yet appropriated, the shifting of funds between votes or what's also called varements, the utilization of savings under one vote for another, and the rollover of funds from the preceding financial year. This table, which is not very legible on the screen, but you've got it in front of you, it's also included in the estimates of national expenditure, essentially provides a summary, and that line that shows that we've budgeted for spending of 611 billion, we've added 24 billion rand, including the special adjustments for Eskom, adjusted appropriation bill for Eskom, taking total spending levels to 635 billion rand. The inflation-related adjustments of 7.7 billion, 5 billion of that is for compensation of employees. The budget was based on the assumption that we'll give a 7.5% increase, but Resolution 1 of 2007 indicated that we've got to pay forward-looking CPIX projections plus 1%, and in-year the CPIX projection was much higher, so a 10.5% salary increase was awarded, and that 5 billion rand is the 9-month cost of that 10.5 billion. The school nutrition program gets adjusted for inflation, and it gets additional resources under the unforeseen and unavoidable category. The higher education transfer, learner support materials, medical equipment and medicines, housing costs, fuel costs mainly in police but also in defense and environmental affairs and tourism, and the higher costs of providing free electricity is makes up the rest of the inflation adjustments. Mr. Chair, I think it's important to for the committee to understand that these inflation adjustments were made because if we don't make such inflation adjustments, the most critical public services will be impacted. Medicines, medical equipment, school nutrition, transfers to higher education. And in an environment of high inflation, it's a policy choice to try to protect these areas of spending. And that's why those inflation adjustments were made. In terms of Section 32B, the unforeseen and unavoidable category of spending, the Treasury Committee has approved the following items of adjustments. 10 million rand at the Presidency, mainly because of higher administrative costs as a result of changes at the executive level. The 2.5 billion rand for the Political Office Bearers Pension Fund. Foreign Affairs There are two items there in particular. The first is an exchange rate adjustment. We have an agreement with Foreign Affairs that we budget on the basis of set forecasts for exchange rates. And at the time of the adjustments budget, we do a calculation, and the recalculation suggests that they would need some additional money, $235 million, by our estimate. And then there's a proposed R300 million that will go into the African Renaissance Fund, but will be earmarked for use in Zimbabwe for short-term food interventions. But as the minister announced in the speech, there's a condition attached to that, that this money will be used by reputable food agents, international development agencies, on the agreement of a government, a multi-party government. Home Affairs gets additional resources for items relating to the xenophobic violence and the displacement of people, but also for an advanced passenger processing and information system for the 2010 FIFA World Cup that they've got to buy. The amounts for the elections are also adjusted, partly because of additional polling booths. Zip-zip scanners. The intelligence budget is a small adjustment for inflation on the intelligence budget that falls under Treasury vote. The 1 billion rand there is the transfer to provinces for the occupation specific dispensation of nurses. There's been a significant increase in the capital program under arts and culture relating to the Robben Island Museum that receives additional support. In education, there's a R22 million item for damaged schools in Mpumalanga, and then I mentioned the school nutrition program. The Karihude mass literacy program receives additional resources. It's been quite a successfully run program so far. The HIV and AIDS treatment program and the expansion of new drug regimens for mother-to-child transmission receives additional resources, mainly because take-up and demand has been higher than anticipated. I've mentioned the R500 million set aside for the social relief of distress. Under sport and recreation, the R1.4 billion is for the World Cup stadiums. And again, under Vote 24, that R600 million there is for last-mile access. Defense receives additional resources because they've had to stay in Burundi slightly longer than anticipated. Agriculture receives additional resources both for disasters but also a R76 million item for agricultural starter packs. Again, one of those interventions that was designed to mitigate the short-term impact of higher food prices. There are several disaster-related adjustments under provincial and local government, the details of which are set out in the adjusted estimates. Flooding in the Western and Eastern Cape in November, flooding in the Western Cape in July this year, storm damage in KwaZulu-Natal in June this year, and then temporary accommodation for people who were displaced in the xenophobic violence. Public enterprises receives R259.7 million as the second tranche of an indemnity claim by Danel Saab Aerostructures under the indemnity agreement between the government, Saab, and Danel. This essentially relates to a penalty, the second of the penalty clauses that have kicked in relation to the A400M contract. The Road Accident Fund receives $2.5 billion, but let me spend a moment explaining that this amount is split into two. R1.3 billion of this was transferred under Section 16 of the PFMA because the Road Accident Fund had literally run out of cash and had stopped paying grant beneficiaries. And so the Minister of Finance used Section 16 of the PFMA to recommend that R1.3 billion be transferred. And in terms of Section 16 of the PFMA, he has informed the Speaker of Parliament and the Chair of the NCOP and copied the Chair of the Portfolio Committee on Finance on this matter. R1.2 billion is then unforeseen and unavoidable spending that is being requested in the adjustments appropriation bill now. Those two amounts total 2.5 billion rand. There's also significant allocations for roads, mainly relating to disasters, bridges washed away, etc., etc. Moving on to supplementary amounts announced in the budget, there are three supplementary amounts, the largest of which is the Eskom amount, but we'll deal with that separately. The Minister of Finance set aside or announced that 2 billion rand over a three-year period will be set aside for things related to energy efficiency, the investment in renewable resources, co-generation projects, improving the energy efficiency of government buildings, and so forth. And 180 million rand is allocated to the Department of Minerals and Energy, mainly in this case for the purchase of compact fluorescent light bulbs, and 20 million rand to the Department of Public Works to retrofit government buildings to improve their energy efficiency. Mr. Chair, I won't go through the detailed rollovers. I'll just mention some of the larger amounts. Foreign Affairs receives 500 million rand in rollovers, mainly to facilitate early works agreements on their large new head office in Pretoria North. Home Affairs receives additional resources for its IT projects, both relating to voice over internet protocol and the Harness project. There's been slower spending than anticipated in the Rehabisa Chwane program and the Lubombo port of entry on Public Works' vote. Health receives a rollover of 374 million for slightly slower spending, both on their Civitas head office, but also mainly in the hospital revitalization grant, though there's additional resources for the HIV and AIDS programs and a small amount for the National Health Laboratory Services. I think that... Correctional Services receives 206 million for completion of the Kimberley Correctional Facility. Defence 240 million, and there are three items there. The largest of which is repairs and maintenance, but there's also significant construction costs relating to the rehabilitation of the Waterkloof Air Force Base. Water Affairs and Forestry receives a rollover of 269 million for completion of the De Werp Dam, accelerated construction there. And then Agriculture receives a rollover for money that was allocated but not spent relating to agricultural disasters. Mr. Chair, there are several self-financing items. This is where the department has received resources. And it needs to be appropriated back to them. There are three items. The first is on foreign affairs. The public-private partnership agreement provides for the reimbursement of the department in terms of the early works agreement. Basically, if government puts in a larger share of the capital, then the unitary charge, part of the unitary charge, is reimbursed to the department. Defence has generated 120 million rand from the sale of assets. And transport, the largest item there is revenues generated from the eNatus project that goes back to the department. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, there was 4.3 billion rand of declared savings. Sorry, that's an error. That should be from 2007-08. And of that, 2.4 billion has been recommended for rollovers. There's projected underspending of 1.2 billion. There's some projected underspending and savings in this year, and that takes the total expenditure level from 611 to 635 billion rand. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
We are being asked to take a 5 minute break so that the people can walk in and sit where we're sitting to find out what's happening. 5 minutes will be the rest, and we're going to be back here.
What can go off them? They don't know already.
This poll seems to be a great waste of time. It implies that the MPs weren't listening yesterday. And didn't read this morning's paper.
We've taken two submissions, two presentations. The first one was on the medium-term budget policy statement. And one of the reasons why I said perhaps because we are still able to hear Kuben, let's proceed whilst that mic was working in the interest of time before we take questions and comments from members. Because I thought by then this thing would have been sorted out, and now that it is sorted out, can I request Kuben also to sit properly now? And whoever the minister wants to be able to take questions on the MTBPS and the adjustments appropriation. But let's first take questions on the MTBPS, and then we will move on to the adjustments appropriation. I have Mr. Maloto and Mr. Maret, Dr. George, Mr. Johnson, Ms. Phelps on the MTBPS, and Mr. Swart.
Oh yeah, so double LER, luminous, and they had a house, open in a museum to himself, across his house, I tell you.
Thank you, Chair. My first question is based on a statement that National Treasurer has made on page 33. Well, I'll read it. It says, given the current volatility in global markets and a high current account deficit, debt management policy is focused on managing external vulnerability. I'm more interested in the last part of debt management policies focused on managing external vulnerability. I just want to check with you what measures have you taken to deal with this external vulnerability in the light of this statement. Obviously, you've got some bonds, foreign bonds, of possibly which might be maturing soon. Have you done any work to ensure that whether you lengthen the maturity of those bonds so that we should reduce our external vulnerability in the short term? The second question, Chair, is on what has been happening globally on the banking side. I just want to find out what lessons have we drawn as government to ensure that those experiences don't happen in South Africa. Obviously, I mean, there have been some weaknesses in the system, whether it's a matter of surveillance, early detections of the problems. So I just want to find out from our side, what have we learned that we feel that we need to focus on, whether it's issues of banks keeping certain activities off their balance sheets. Are we happy with those developments? The other question, Chair, it's based on a statement, I've just lost it, but the Guven and the DG will be able to share the page, where they indicated that the spread has increased. Now, my question would be based on two situations. One, we are saying that the SOEs have to undertake major capital investment. I just, what portion of the money will be sourced domestically, and what portion will be sourced internationally, given the risks that we have mentioned, that the spread has increased? And also, well, maybe we are in a fortunate situation that we had a budget surplus, and now we are moving into a small deficit. But let me just put a hypothetical situation which is not there. If we had to have a budget deficit of 4%, what risk would that pose to us? Because I assume that some of the money would have to go and get it offshore. But given this spread, how are we going to manage that? Chair, I think that should be it, and then I can ask the rest of the questions when we deal with the adjustment.
Thank you. Mr. Murray?
Thank you, Chair. My first question is on page 20 of the policy statement. There was one portion of that paragraph that was interesting to me, and it says, over the short term, a growing interest rate differential between South Africa and developed economies will be another factor supporting capital inflows. Now, we know that we need foreign investment and capital to fund the deficit on the balance of payment, and we know that there's not a huge amount of fixed capital investment. Now, to what extent is this a real factor when considering the repo rates? We know that this will most certainly influence the value of the rand and obviously investors' confidence. So there's a lot of things that will follow from that as well. Secondly, you have mentioned about employment creation and incentives for employment creation, and specifically you have also mentioned non-government employers. Now, what does that mean, and to what extent and in what form do you intend that this incentives to non-government employers must follow? And then thirdly, and the last one for the moment, you have made mention about more efficiency and higher efficiency rate within government as well. And you've also mentioned that sometimes we've got a good policy, but the implementation of that is not proper done. And that's why we've also got rollovers or just incorrectly spended funds. I haven't picked up specific measures what you intend or what you recommend must be done to those departments and also those state-owned enterprises that is just drawing money. To what extent will you look at that, and what is your views on that specifically? Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. George? Members, I did not remind members about the three-question rule because members know the rule. I've never been prone to reminding them again. They are so good at sticking to it. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. I only have one question, and it relates to the tax revenue. The expectation is that it will remain unchanged. But given the economic slowdown, it would be expected that corporate tax in particular would reduce. So is it that inflation is compensating for that reduction? Is the inflation offsetting that, therefore making it equal? Or should there actually be a reduction? Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. There's two questions. My first one relates to a broader...
Can you try the other one, Mr. Johnson?
Can you hear me now?
They fixed all of them except yours.
My first question relates to a broader debate about a developmental state. Listening to the budget, a policy statement, I'm still struggling to really get to hear the minister saying, yes, we are walking the talk. yes, there are challenges insofar as the global factors that obviously are affecting our own developing economy. And we also are confronted with the realities of, you know, lower revenue that we are anticipating. One of the other issues that we are still to hear government talking about is a review that was expected on the development financial institutions. To what an extent are those really doing what is expected of them, so that you don't have a continued situation wherein they operate like you are going to hear any commercial bank offering. To an extent, some of our DFIs, they even become a lot worse than, you know, those commercial banks in terms of their offerings. That's the first one. Well, related to that, again, is equally an issue of underspending and saving, given the kinds of macroeconomic situation that we're confronted with as a country and the challenges thereof. So that's the first one, Chair. The second one, very briefly, the Minister spoke about some of the expected spend insofar as specifically here on social side of things, to be more direct. Old age, I would imagine we're still on track here, Chair. There was an expected increase effectively from October of 20 rands, to be precise. Now, you have an inflation that is talking here anything to a tune of about 13%. Now, when I did my quick one, I literally have here 820 rands of 780 to be equal to 2.5%. And the rationale that I heard from the minister yesterday was that you have here a situation where, given all these challenges of inflation, at least for now, yes, in February you are still going to hear more stories, especially in that direction. However, this to me poses a serious question as to whether it does talk, you know, to what is expected of what the minister was alluding to. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much, Minister. If one looks at some of... I hope it's not the same as Mr. Johnson's. Is that better, Chair? Right. In that... as everyone has agreed in the country and outside the country internationally, times are turbulent, and the deleveraging that is occurring in the United States is in fact calling for more funding. And yet, we make it clear within the MTBPS statement that the falling oil prices, that's page 13, and lower food costs will help to bring inflation back towards the 3-6% target range. And yet another statement alluded to in this book, we're well aware that the position of the rand to some extent dilutes the price, you know, the oil price decline. Now if we can have just some comment on that direction. The other one is with respect to the statement made in grey, which concerns the global crisis, which underpins what I've said on page 20, the reference here that global funding squeeze benefiting the dollar and emerging market currencies falling is due to increased against the emerging markets will just be remain the same because of the increased risk aversion that exists. Now, when you link that to the current account situation, which the reference is made that in the first half of 2008, that the increase or surplus in capital inflows had mitigated or had addressed that current account deficit. Now, it would appear as if, judging from what has been said, that the capital inflows, that there is a risk in a decline to some extent there. How else, what other measures are we looking at to address the current account situation? And finally, just perhaps a clarification on page 21, there's a comparison made in the third paragraph, halfway down, about the nominal effective rand exchange rate, and the months given in the first instance refer to January and October, and then the comparison with the real exchange is January to July. Now, as we all know, the situation really got dramatically worse after July, and I wondered exactly what the comparison would be if we made the period comparable. Thank you, Chair.
Let's start.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Minister, for the presentations and DGs. My questions relate to local government and particularly page 64 of the medium term budget policy statement. Note that a portion of the fuel levy will be used to replace RSC levies to metros. Whether that's the correct application of fuel levies, I won't discuss that at the moment, but the problem is that I think by 2011 DMAs will be sorted out. They will be no longer be. The result being that we will have wall-to-wall municipalities, and the question is whether district municipalities will then still be required, first of all. Secondly, we see on page 64 that the government's looking at other forms maybe of income for local authorities, and I was wondering whether we can have any indication of what other forms of income are being considered at the moment.
Thank you. That's the lot in the next page.
Yeah. Okay. Let me skim the easy ones and leave these smart people to deal with the difficult ones. From Mr. Malone's questions, let me touch on the issue of the lessons of the banking crisis. Now, I think the first point that we should note is that the Glass-Steagall Act in the United States had separated out between what now is called in the parlance Wall Street and High Street. But the Act actually fell into desuetude. And so everybody's involved in similar kinds of things, but some institutions lean more towards deposit taking than others. But the Act, to all intents and purposes, is gone. Now, in the context of this, the emphasis placed certainly during the last 15 years on the financial sector as a key growth sector has been a major concern. And I draw these observations in an environment where in discussions we've had people are of the view that it's too early to draw the lessons. I disagree because I think that there are some issues. And one of the features that we touched on in the speech yesterday was the credit default swaps, the CDS, that came from nowhere. In fact, we now know where it came from. By 2000, had accounted for some 100 billion. And by the end of 2007, had accounted for, what was it, 64 trillion dollars. Now, growth like that, at that exponential rate can't be supported by anything in reality. Now, there were big debates during the period between Greenspan's view that these are just bubbles on a steady stream, and some other views that said you need to know what's going down. Clearly that those issues would need to be spoken of. If you take the views articulated just yesterday by President Sarkozy about hedge funds and about the earnings of people in the financial sector and some mechanisms to deal with the exuberance, you also need to factor in some views expressed in Germany earlier this year, which describe these hedge funds and private equity funds as locusts. They eat everything in sight and move on and eat everything in sight in the next country. I think that there is a groundswell amongst policymakers now that would compel us to take a view of what is taking place. Because you know, you can go back in the literature. And this idea that you can grow economies on the basis of only what happens in the financial sector has to be so fundamentally wrong. The other issue, of course, is that, you know, in the current environment, people are tracking very closely what happens minute by minute. And in tracking through the volatility indices on the stock exchanges, you know, on the Dow, for instance, the measure between highs and lows is quite unprecedented. 1,000 points in a single trading day is not rational behavior. Moreover, it's now clear that the bulk of trades are happening in the last hour of trade. People are dumping or engaging in some other price manipulation. And the question being asked very strongly, even by supervisors in the United States, is what role the hedge funds are playing in this. So I don't want to suggest that we have all of the answers, but I think that we're sitting in an environment where we're taking stock of all of these things, equipping ourselves to deal with it. Institutionally, I think there are a series of questions. One of them is what role the IMF should be playing in this. And it's part of the work we're looking at, because I chair this task team on governance there. But there's also great emphasis on the G20. And the G20 meeting will be held sort of 7th, 8th, and 9th of November in Brazil. And a very strong emphasis on the fact that the G20 must play this role. There's also a call, a very strong call, from a number of heads of state or government in the G20 who are arguing that the G7 has outlived its usefulness, that the G20 must actually move into the center stage. Sarkozy yesterday was talking about a G13, but I think that it's likely to be a group that takes account of the systemically significant countries. And, you know, part of what we need to go to Brazil with are a set of ideas that will help us understand the present and be able to deal with it going forward. Your other questions, including the numbers on the budget deficit, the DG will either do or allocate. Mr. Murray, on the employment creation, look, let me say that the only way to deal with this is to look at it in a variety of different parts. Like the financial markets, we have to dice and slice as well. The one part that we dealt with in the statement yesterday is our commitment to the expanded public works program. But you know, those jobs tend to be job opportunities. They tend to be of short duration. It's a preparation for phase two. And it will involve a number of non-governments, as is the case now, but I think it, some of those areas are likely to be accelerated. The other issues arise in the context of the microeconomic reforms that we've spoken of, both in respect of trade and industrial policy, small and medium enterprise development, and the labor markets policy, and the big, big challenge of trying to smooth the school-to-work transition. At this stage, we're providing a resource and flagging. I think we'll come back to these issues in February, because we've also turned up the heat a bit, but perhaps Kuben would like to come back on that issue in a moment. On the question of efficiency of spending, Chair, I am the executive authority for a number of departments. Members of this committee are empowered by law to inquire into the efficiency of spending in the departments that I'm responsible for. And in the National Treasury, this gentleman here is the accounting officer. He's called that because he has to account to Parliament. I believe that it's Parliament's role to assess the efficiency of spending. Let me restate that I believe that Parliament must actually ask that the measurable objectives be clarified, that they might have to be diced into quarters, and that reporting should be clear. Parliament has a role to play to ensure that departments, you know, sometimes in the budget votes, portfolio committees get up and they say, ow, ow, department doesn't have enough money. It's not their job, I'm afraid. It's not their job. The job of Parliament is to say, have you spent as planned? Parliament must ask whether the money was actually utilized as planned. Parliament must ask whether the plans are sufficiently detailed. Parliament mustn't ask how much money there is. Parliament must ask what the money bought. And I think that those are the checks and balances in the system. That's what the PFMA describes the role of Parliament as being. Now, I know that, that committees like this are exceedingly overwhelmed, Chair. But I think that we must have, certainly, you know, I'm sure that, that members of this committee are preparing their speeches for this afternoon on the procedure to amend money bills and related matters. But as you prepare, my pleading is build this issue in because it's so fundamental. And if you're making all the budgets, then you actually can't see. You won't be able to see where the inefficiencies are. Who's watching? Who's guarding the guardians? Dr. George, let me turn your attention to page 32 of the PFMA. And, sorry, amen, of the medium-term budget policy, forgive me. The estimate for revenue in the current year is 27.6%. Have you got the budget review? Page 46. The budget review has a similar table. It's also called Table 3.3. And its revenue is 28.4% of GDP. The number in for the 28.4% is 580.4 billion. This is in the budget review I'm referring to now. 28.4% of GDP, and 27.6. is 653.5. So that the percentage of GDP has fallen, the nominal amount has increased, and that's what makes up the difference that we talk about. Mr. Johnson's first question is about the development finance institutions. Now, I think, Chair, that we must have a full and specific discussion on the development finance institutions. Frequently, the issue of access is an important dimension of financing. But, you know, behavior in society determines rates. Inflation in society determines rates. And so clearly there are issues, but part of the proposals that are underway is for the formation of a council, because the one issue that we have come to understand very clearly is that because the DFIs report to different ministries, they hear different drumbeats. So there needs to be a higher level of coordination across the DFIs, and that is work in progress. On the issue of underspending, perhaps Kuben can come in a moment, or we could defer it to the discussion on the. May I suggest that we defer it to a discussion on the adjustments? So we deal with that as a first question, because, you know, there are requests for rollovers, there are rollovers approved, there are cessions to the Treasury, there are savings. It's very important to just cover the ground on that and be able to explain that in the context. Chair, when Mr. Johnson was speaking, you may have observed that I asked for a copy of the PFMA. And the reason I asked for a copy of the PFMA is because in terms of the issues for which in-year appropriations can be made, exclude inflationary adjustments. About fiscal targets, it's what's regarded as unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure. In my tenure as Minister of Finance, this is the first time we've made an in-year adjustment to any grants. But this committee can vote it down, Chair. This committee can vote it down and say, in the letter and spirit of the PFMA, don't give pensioners anything. This doesn't substitute for anything. I don't want to cover the ground of the fiscal pressure that we're under at the moment, but, you know, the committee can vote it down.
Maybe just a quick one on that one. The interest for me is that what's the rationale for you to arrive at 820 rand? Not so much whether it is good or not. Just the understanding, that's the point I was trying to get it.
We can deal with it, but, I'll ask Ruben to deal with it in a moment, but ask Mr. Johnson to just go back and look at the number that was included in February as an increase. Let me stop there and ask first the search and then Ruben to come in.
Okay. The number, what was the number? 70 rands. So it's actually 90 rands in the year. It's actually, we should be talking 90 rands because this is in addition to the 70 that the pension has got. But yeah, I'll come back.
Okay, Ken.
Yeah, that's me.
Mr. Chair, just on this specific one, yes, there were 60 rand in April, and there's a further 20 rand now, so it's 80 rand. However, on the child support grant, there was 10 rand in April and 20 rand now, which is 30 rand. So the increase on the child support grant is over 15%. It was a choice, I think, to increase the child support grant by higher than inflation, partly because it reaches more households, the 8 million child support grant beneficiaries. The cost of that, full year cost of that is 960 million rand, the extra 10 rand. So I think it was in that spirit that we made those grant adjustments.
Okay, proceed, DG.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know why I'm stuck with the difficult questions, but the two questions that I would have to do, the Minister says that I must deal with this Mulechi stuff, but the questions, there were two that came from Mr. Moloto, which somehow also link to a question that Mr. Mare raised, so I will deal with all three at the same time. I think that the question was, there is a focus to reduce external vulnerability. What is it that is being done to reduce external vulnerability? There are three interventions that we had to make. The first one had to do with the fiscal stance that we took in the past 2 years, which said that the current account deficit is a savings investment imbalance, and if we want to continue on the investment trajectory that we had chosen, it would mean that we will have to increase savings. And when you look backwards, you would actually realize that the two laggards in the national savings equation had been government and the household sector. So government had to consciously take that decision to drive savings itself, to deal with this external vulnerability and correct the imbalance. The second was to say that during that period, because we were also running a budget surplus, that we would actually use the surpluses to accumulate additional reserves. And you have to accumulate the reserves because when a country is faced with a vulnerability with respect to the current account, the first risk comes from an inability to refinance short-term debt. And this links then to the third area of intervention which Mr. Moloto might have alluded to, which has to do with what you are doing with a short-term debt. What we had been doing as a matter of course in the domestic market had been to engage in switch auctions, which meant that we offered investors longer-dated debt that matures in 10, 15, or 20 years, or 30 years, and said to the investors, you are holding the following pieces of paper that is maturing in the next year or in the next 2 years, we would like to get you to buy the longer dated paper and sell the short dated paper to us. So such a transaction would take place and the monies involved are not that big, the actual exchanges of the money, but these switch auctions are actually significantly big. We move out of short term debt into long term debt. Last year, for the first time, we embarked in something similar to a switch auction. Others called it a debt exchange, where we looked at debt that was maturing, short-term debt in international capital markets, and offered investors to switch out of our short-term debt to a 15-year bond maturing 2022. Just to give you an idea, at that time, we priced that bond, the new bond, at a spread of 65 basis points above midterm swaps. And at the time, 65 basis points is 0.65%. At the time, the Minister of Finance asked me, how did you convince the investors to enter into this debt exchange? And I said to him that we took them down a dark alley and broke their kneecaps. So we managed to take out this short-term debt out of the market in a debt exchange. But the question that Mr. Muloto raises was, in this environment, what is happening to spreads? We say spreads are widening. I get this this update on spreads. That bond that we priced at 65 basis points in May of last year, it traded at just over 400 basis points last week when we were in Washington. The figure that I got on Monday was that it was trading at 580 basis points, which means it's 5.8% above where the U.S. government actually borrows. The spread widened has been driven by two factors. The first one sounds counterintuitive, because in this environment, people are saying that they are taking a flight to quality. And guess where they are flying to? Flying to the U.S., but that is where the problem is. So that drives that. And then, of course, the second one is basically global risk aversion. Nobody wants to buy anything new. And what we have seen has been that people sell these things. And the question was, where do they put the money? Because the banks, they don't trust the banks anymore. So they buy short-dated U.S. Treasury bills. As a result, U.S. Treasury bills, the yield there drops something like 0.5%. Now, if you go and buy U.S. Treasury bills and earn 0.5%, and inflation in the U.S. is about 3.84%, then it just tells you the amount of irrationality that is out there. People are fearful. So that is what would drive them to do things like that. What that does, in some or not, is that it does pose a serious challenge for us in terms of accessing international capital markets. So what many SOEs have been doing, including ESCOM, was to negotiate export credits with export credit agencies. So for the sourcing of equipment from any of these big countries, there is an export agency that will be prepared to fund this thing. But normally they would not fund more than 85% of the goods that you buy. The difference, you must still go and raise from elsewhere. So that is a challenge. Two state-owned enterprises last week, which were preparing to enter international capital markets, decided to withdraw. And they are right. I mean, you can't go and borrow at this rate in international capital markets. It made sense for them to retreat. And we're fortunate because we have got very deep domestic capital markets, which, thanks to government fiscal strength, government has not quite crowded out those SOEs. They could actually enter that market. And the last question that I had to then deal with was the question by Mr. Mare, where we say that interest differentials underpin the flows. Yes, they do underpin these flows. Does this go into the decision-making process about the repo? I think that if Mr. Mare, you wait for the governor when he appears here in the committee and ask him, because I do not like him commenting about fiscal policy, so I will not say anything about monetary policy.
Mr. Chair, if I could just quickly deal with one or two things. One of the objectives of the Expanded Public Works Program Phase 2 is to shift from a grant-based program towards a performance-based program. What that essentially means is, at the moment, we give a municipality 100 rand, we say we'd like you to build a rural road, but we'd like you to use labor-intensive methods. The objective is to fund the rural road, and sometimes the municipality will adhere to the conditions of using labor-intensive methods. In the main, it's worked in some areas, but it's mainly worked to create short-term type employment. The second phase envisages incentivizing municipalities, NGOs, and government departments to offer longer-term jobs in grass-cutting, school maintenance, certain municipal services that are not short-term in nature. They're permanent jobs. There might be a high turnover, but they're permanent jobs. And the idea is to actually incentivize them, to pay these municipalities to use greater labor-intensive methods. So that's from that question. I'd just like to point out that in the adjusted estimates of national expenditure this year, for the first time for most departments, not all, but we published mid-year performance status. So, for example, the Department of Communication, they had a target of connecting 250 Dinaleri schools with IT connectivity. In the first 6 months, they've achieved zero. Percentage of public broadcasting infrastructure digitized, the target was 50%, first 6 months, zero. Number of reports on corporate governance of public entities, target was two, first 6 months was zero. Number of post offices that would promote universal access, target was 85, achieved seven. We've gone out of our way in the Treasury over the last 13, 14 years to empower Parliament with this kind of information so that they can hold government departments to account. It's limited to what we can do other than this kind of information. And this kind of information we think is quite useful in helping Parliament to hold government departments to account. Thank you.
We're going to ask the acting DDG for intergovernmental fiscal relations, Mr. Brown, to respond to Mr. Swartz's three questions, please.
Thanks, Minister, Honourable Chair. On the DMAs will be folded into the respective local municipalities that they fall under, basically from 2011 onwards. But the districts, in their current form, the district municipalities will continue to exist. But the future of the districts also will be determined by the current review process that's underway, led by DPLG itself. So by January, February, we will get some kind of an indication of where that process would be headed. But having said that, in the interim, the fuel, or rather the RSC levy replacement grant that goes to these districts will be kept for those districts until the future of these districts have been finalized. What other sources of revenue are we looking into? We are of the opinion that the VAT zero rating that we've put in as a basket for the metropolitan municipalities, together with the current proposal on the fuel levy, is sufficient to cover our obligation in terms of the replacement. But the municipal fiscal powers and functions legislation also put in place some kind of a process where municipalities can start on their own to explore other sources of revenue. But having said that, SAGA, for example, is now currently exploring other sources. They are, for example, now looking at the local business tax, for example. Some people have been talking about transfer duties, but what is important in proposing some of these sources is the issue around the fluctuation of these revenue sources so that we don't create instability in the revenue base of some of these municipalities. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much. The last question will come from Mr. Mguni.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to remind the minister and his officials of the two requests that the committee made, and they are still waiting for them. First is the donor funding. You know, it constitutes a very small percentage of the budget, but we'd like to know how much and the conditions are attached.
Sorry, Mr. Mguni, will you please speak into the mic?
I'm saying, first of all, the donor funding. We know it constitutes a small percentage of the budget, but we'd like to know the conditions attached to it and how much is it, what is it for, which departments. The second one is on the issue of DFIs, that in the trial report, it says that there's a tracking of DFIs. We're still waiting for the report to hear how far this department gone and what are the proposals on DFIs. Coming to my questions, Chair. I just want to make a remark that the three questions rules at some stage disadvantages us. I think we will revisit that issue. My first question is page 17 on the flexible, or rather the competitive exchange rate. I'll just like to know from the Minister or the DG, what do they think is the competitive exchange rate? Seeing that we've got a floating exchange rate in South Africa. It has been asked from time again, but you are referring of a competitive exchange rate. I just want to know what you think is a competitive exchange rate.
Do you include questions that we can't answer in the three?
The member has the right to ask any question.
On page 17. My second question is on the. It's actually not answered. It's on the current account deficit. When we were meeting the IMF around June this year, they told us the current account deficit now poses a risk in South Africa for outside investors. And also, quoting the, or rather, just referring to the governor, what says that it is now time for reality. The time for the textbooks. Textbook theory is we have to review that because things now are changing due to the credit crunch that we're experiencing and the meltdown, economic meltdown. He said it's now time to sometimes put the textbook theory aside and do it reality. Now, taking that into consideration, I just like to know how is the department planning to deal with this current account deficit. Are you thinking of any other stabilizing policies or any intervention policies that you've got up on your sleeves? And my last question, Chair. It's on economic growth. It has been now scaled down or revised 3.7%. At some stage last year, I asked the minister, is he not optimistic that you are going to get a 4% economic growth rate? He said there was nothing wrong being optimistic. I just want to find out now. Are they still optimistic that you are going to get a 3.7% growth this current year? Now I know it has been revised down to 3% next year. And they are seeing that it is our GDP is actually linked to a world GDP. When the world GDP when it rises, our GDP also rises, and it falls when it falls. I just want to hear your views on that. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Wow, there are more questions coming. Yeah. I'll take Mr. Spetu Asia. You will follow Mema Shiro. Then the co-chair of budget. Do you want to go for the second round?
No,
just one question. Yeah, but I've realized that changing chairs, the rule, it seems people are ignoring the three question rule. It seems so, and let us stick to the three question rule. Changing chairs means nothing.
You said it needs to be reviewed.
Then. Yeah. will take you in that sequence.
Thank you, Chair. Well, this question was asked, but I've not fairly covered on it, the issue of the problems in terms of the international economy, the Congo fever, which is going on. I think I want to make a suggestion, Chair, that I don't know when are we going to do that. That will be given a depth discussion and briefing around that by the department as a committee, so that you can be able to understand it properly. Now, this synopsis which we're getting is the synopsis which we got in Parliament yesterday and here. So you will not be able to explain in detail in your constituency as to what is going on. So I think that it will be of a paramount importance. The other one is a general observation, Chairperson. As young as I am, before 1999, all departments were planning for millennium goals. Now it's 2010, most of them is 2010 World Cup. I wonder what will happen after 2010? Is it a global warming planning? Do we have a clear planning as the government as to what are we planning for and budgeting for? Because you see, all projects now are 2010 World Cup, 2010 World Cup. Then it was a millennium. It is going to be global warming, I'm definitely sure. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. And my question will be on the...
will be on Northeast schools. And because there's an allocation on Northeast schools. Is it? Yes.
Thank you, Minister. My question is going to be on Northeast schools, because there's allocation of this 3 billion, which goes to Northeast schools and goes to the provinces. And according to the FFC, there was that implementation challenges where children from one house could attend different schools. I should actually say the tools used to choose the Northeast schools, because it creates a problem. Was this allocation based on a national standard that you allocate this money because these tools are going to be used, or was it just that, no, let's give it to the provinces and they'll continue the way they used to continue, which disadvantaged some children, others from the same house and others from different communities, where one community could have schools on different quintile levels and children from the same house attending different schools and one paying, one not paying. So I just wanted to understand the standard used for allocations of Northeast schools.
Yeah, Mr. Sogoni?
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe I should ask my maiden question, if there's something like that in this committee that I would like to ask. Well, my first question is related to the issue of one of the government priorities is to reduce poverty in the rural areas, and the focus seems to be on access to land. Now, clearly, it's clear that over the past 14 years, I think that on the question of access to land, we have not what you call succeeded. perhaps what is it that is I mean, is there something that is being done perhaps to relook at this what you call approach in terms of one as I've indicated in terms of access to land, but secondly a lot of people from the rural areas are moving towards the urban areas. Are we then succeeding then in this approach of trying to keep people there, but only based on the issue of access to land only? The second one, Chair, is around this new target measure of inflation. What are the advantages of this target? I mean, of this approach. And related to that is the issue of this approach isn't going to, I mean, is it going to give a true reflection of your CPI? Thank you.
Mr. Mulato, that's the last question.
Yes, I'll be quick, and my question is less controversial. I think it was just one line in the minister's speech yesterday where you talked about the issue of equity in banking. Now, my question would be, in the light of the debates in the financial sector charter around issues of black economic empowerment, there is a view that, you know, equity capital that's being put by the owners of the bank becomes your first line of defense. It cushions you against the losses. Now, if you bring in partners who are highly leveraged, you know, who are carrying a lot of debt, in an event of a crisis, now, what do you do? Because, like, for instance, if you bring it back to the current crisis now, a lot of banks' capital has been eroded, and sovereign funds had to come in to replenish that debt, and even governments in certain instances had to recapitalize the banks. Now, how do we manage to balance this thing? Because for me, it's a bit tricky, and maybe I'm not well learned in these areas, of having partners who are highly leveraged, carrying a lot of debt. In the event of a crisis, we say equity capital. Those who know better than I do, they say it comes to your first line of defense. It must cushion you against the losses. Now, already you are sitting with a bit of a huge debt. You know, we have got partners who are not going to assist unless we are talking about petrol dollars in the event of a crisis, that we'd have to get petrol dollars from the mid.
Your question was not responded.
It was not responded to.
Yeah, but somebody has asked it for you on your behalf again. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Minister, Ms. Faf says the third question was not responded to, but I just want to make this plea that the questions that are related to the adjustment appropriation, don't respond to them now. You'll take them during the second batch of questions when we go to the adjustment appropriation. Mr. Mgoni,
There's one question that was answered to us from Mr. Mulato, but I had the same question on the banks. How does the current meltdown affect our banks, especially on the issues that are not on the bank balance sheet, Mr. Lord, this question, especially on securitizations of debt by banks and then the ticket of the books. Because the governor said it's nice to keep the books, but when asked him recently, he says no, the banks are taking those securitizations back into their books. How does it pose risk in this meltdown?
I'm trying to work out, is that the Honourable Mgoni's 18th question this morning.
I think Mr. Mgoni is taking advantage of the changing of the chairs.
Chair,
I also have a slight problem. You see, Amanda is standing behind you, Minister, because she has been there since 11 o'clock, and I thought we would break at 11:30, grab tea and come back. Because what's going to happen now, they are going to bring lunch whilst there's still tea outside. I don't know.
I'll take 3 minutes on this, Chair.
Okay. Maybe let's do that and then quickly break for tea and come back and take responses.
Chair, on the questions on donor funding and the DFIs, I think we can submit a full report. The DFIs report is complete. There are certain implementation procedures in government to try and bring together the different ministers I referred to earlier when Mr. Johnson had asked the question, but the report I think is available. On the competitive exchange rate, how long is a piece of string, Mr. Nguni? Clearly it's not a question that we would answer. We aren't traders, we don't make calls on that. I go back to all of the policy statements we've made. We want a stable competitive exchange rate. But as they say in the classics, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. I think that obviously the governor's correct. You see, part of the issues of current accounts and so on, the bulk of the textbooks were written for an environment when sovereign states had fuller control. Now, how much control do you have? How much control does the U.S. have over its oil imports? How do adjusted prices with differential exchange rates impact on supply and demand patterns across the globe? At what kind of stage is the current account a deficit, a real concern? I think that in a world that is differently globalized, I mean, amongst the questions that would have to be answered, and I go back to what I said earlier in response to Mr. Mulotto, how does this world function differently? You would have seen at a meeting in Brussels last week, a summit of EU heads of state, a very strong call for Bretton Woods 2 conference. Because basically, the system, and you know, very central to the Articles of Association that gave rise to the IMF in New Hampshire in 1944 at the Bretton Woods conference, very central to that is the ability of an institution to deal with balance of payment support. But the call for Bretton Woods 2 suggests that the institutions have actually, certainly the fund has passed its sell-by date. You need to think about this issue quite differently. So in that regard, don't be surprised if I echo the governor in saying, let's put the textbooks aside for the moment. There's a different approach that we need. As we deal with these issues, you know, I don't want to sound disrespectful at all, but some of these things you kind of just do. You don't announce that we are considering A, B, C, D, E, and we will start implementing it later because it could be quite dangerous because there's a lot of profit riding on stuff. So you can't show your hand all the time. And I just ask that members recognize that in a world where people have made so much money and governments are now saying we must cool it down a bit, that there's likely to be resistance to some of these things. Of course, we remain pretty optimistic, Honorable Nguni, but not unrealistically so. I don't think that we can afford to be reckless at all. It's measured. Honorable Asiya, yes. I'd like another discussion on the international economy. In fact, I was asking the DG why, ahead of a discussion like that, if indeed it can be accommodated, we don't prepare a little pamphlet so that when we have a discussion, it can be from the same information. You know, I said in the press conference yesterday that one of the difficulties is that the press doesn't help to inform. The press editorializes everything in South Africa. Sometimes you think that some of them, the journalists, are spokespersons for particular individuals or particular groupings. So we're left uninformed. You know, on a day when the Dow was going through its most difficult issue, our public broadcaster chose to lead with a story about Joel Santana's inability to speak English. Now, I think it's disrespectful to all of us as South Africans. And we must be heard about these issues. It can't be correct. Every television station around the world was carrying the story. We are interested in the football coach and his ability to speak English. It can't be correct. I think that as South Africans we deserve a better quality press. We need an information flow that helps people understand. Let's deal with that. Memashechu on the no fee schools. Let's come back to that. It's not a treasury function. I mean, there's an interaction between Stats SA and the Department of Education in how they do the zoning and so on. Kuben may know something about this, but it's not a treasury function. We can come back, Mr. Tsigoni, to the land issue on the new measure for inflation. There was a very brief pamphlet that was prepared by Stats SA. Do members have it? Okay. It explains what the new measure looks like. And it also, I think, deals with some debate that took place, because what Stats SA did was, over a year they ran two measures so they could understand what the interactions are, what the movements are, and at the conclusion thereof there's actually a sign-off, because the methodology that they employed has been supported by people who work in this area around the world in these statistical agencies and have gone through similar processes of change. At this stage, and you know, we've had very intensive discussions across departments, just trying to understand what the impact would be, and recognizing the independence of Stats SA for its measure. I think we're reasonably assured that there would be continuity, which is why we've kept the target at 3-6%. Oh, Chair, I want to respond to Mr. Muloto's question, but I'm advised by the fact that we're sandwiched between your eyes and the eyes behind me. Yeah. So let's come back to this.
Let's take 5 minutes tea break and come back.
Yeah, because we've taken the other 5 minutes.
Understood that the aeroplane or some sort of part and a penalties incurred, and we couldn't quite get to the issue. These penalties are paid because delivery is not on time. Chair, I am coming to the end now, and perhaps Treasury can tell us, because I know you're not economic with the truth, is exactly, this is the second one, how much more is outstanding? Can you give us a clearer idea of what kind of liability we could be facing in this regard? Thank you, Chairperson.
Ms. Nasir.
Thank you, Chair. One, I'm partially covered by Comrade John on the Nell one. I want just to comment to say that, as I've said earlier on, in the special adjustment, that these SOEs are like a locus, a real locus minister. and denial is the one I can now keep track on it as a locust. The other question, Chairperson, the question is the issue of the rollovers between health and education on HIV and AIDS. Is there any link between the two departments? Or are they working as silos and getting money? We think the Department of Education is educational. But I know that for the fact that the Department of Health went through and began to say that in terms of education, it's going quite well in terms of the HIV and AIDS. The very last one, Chairperson, is the issue of, once more, of the Kimberley prison. When is it going to get into completion, the Kimberley prison? I drive now and then when I'm in Kimberley Pass, I see the construction is going on, but I don't have the tools to be able to say no. Is it going to be completed this time and so on? But it's also one of the departments which is coming from time to time, this thing of the Kimberley. I just hope this one will be the last one. And it's just you are fortunate that we are going, or this department are fortunate that we are going to pass the bill by tomorrow. But if we passed it yesterday, I will stand for some of these things to be affected. Thank you.
I hope the urgency is not occasioned by the need for the Honourable Asiya to find accommodation, Chair.
But when the input was made, they said for completion, which means it's completion, not an alleged completion. Mr. Schneemann?
Thanks, Chair. Now, my question relates to the Road Accident Fund. In the past, there's been allocations made to the Road Accident Fund, and I'm also aware that there's been various legislative amendments and other measures taken to try and address the issue of the Road Accident Fund. But I just want to find out, is this a trend that we expect to continue? How are we going to address the sustainability of the Road Accident Fund in the future? Thanks.
Thanks very much. Minister, you may respond. Oh, just wait a bit, Mr. Sogoni.
Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to, maybe it's a follow-up, somebody asked about the rollovers. With regard to these rollovers, what is the problem? Has it got to do perhaps with the question of capacity to deliver on time? The other day we had a report from the Public Service Commission which showed that one, there was a high vacancy rate, now how it impacts in terms of service delivery, that high vacancy rate. And so what is the relationship perhaps between this rollover and that high vacancy rate? But also maybe this one is could be asked by the function departments themselves, the question of people who are asking for adjustments when it's clear that they do not have the capacity to deliver. There are such, what you call it, departments, especially in the provinces. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Minister. But I would also ask members that when they ask questions, they must be specific so that it becomes clear to the minister. Let me test whether he found specificity somewhere in your question.
Okay, I'm going to ask Kuben Naidu to start, but there was an earlier question that we didn't respond to and said we would. I think it was Mr. Johnson's question that we would explain at this stage, and it relates to rollovers and so on. So let's start there, so that we can put on the table the methodology that's used in all of this, and then be able to deal with these issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Minister. There are several reasons for underspending or in some cases savings. In the main, they deal with delays in the procurement system. They include capacity constraints. They include longer than anticipated tender procedures. In some cases, it's poor planning. And in some departments, the problem is worse than other departments. I'd just like to qualify that with two comments. The first is that in aggregate, the amount of money that we've recommended for rollovers of 2.4 billion rand is 2.4 billion divided by over 500 billion is a relatively small amount. So I think that there is a problem in some departments, but I think we've got to have some perspective that as a share of the budget, it's 0.5% of the budget. The amount of money unspent in 2007-08 was about 4.3 billion rand. That, again, is less than 1% of the total appropriated money. The problem is more serious in some departments where the ratio would be higher. But on aggregate, I think we need to bear that in mind. The second point is that according to the PFMA, we can only recommend something for rollovers if the money is committed. So if there's a vacancy and so you've got unspent personnel funds, you can't roll that over. But if I've tended to build a school and I haven't yet completed the process, you can roll that over because there's a contract issued or there's a tender. If I've ordered school books and it's cash on delivery and they've delivered two tranches but not the third one, I've only paid for two-thirds of the books, you can legitimately roll that over. So the law and the Treasury regulations does specify what we can recommend for rollovers and what we can't recommend for rollovers. Thanks. Thanks.
Earn your salary, young man.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first is on the denial guarantee for the Saab aerostructures. The total guarantee is 1.6 billion rand. The first 1.6 billion rand. So that's the total liability or contingent liability that the state has on this contract. The first tranche of, I think it was about 400 million last year for the first, when the first penalty clause kicked in, we had to table a special adjustments appropriation to deal with that. This is the second penalty clause that's kicked in, and this is 259 million. I think that the Department of Public Enterprises and Danel themselves would probably be in a better position to give you a detailed risk assessment of the remaining amount. But from a Treasury perspective, our total risk was 1.6 billion, and we've paid 660 million. Including this amount. So in theory, the total liability that we, the contingent liability that we still carry on our books is 940 million. We definitely are working with the department and the public entity concerned to try and minimize the risk of future payment. But I think that the committee would be best served by asking questions on the contractual details to public enterprises directly. On the rollovers for the HIV/AIDS in education and health, most of the HIV/AIDS money is spent and spent quite well. There has been some underspending on the life skills programs and the sort of softer preventative measures, which are extremely important. parts of the program, and that's where much of the underspending has occurred. The Department of Education and Health does work together in the delivery of the life skills program. In fact, the life skills money is split between Department of Education and Health. Education funds the school-based life skills programs, and Health funds some of the other preventative measures, including the Love Life campaign. The Kimberley Prison, we, as you have been assured, that this prison will be completed this year, and so we're hopeful that it will be completed this year. On the Road Accident Fund, there's two things that have to be done to improve the sustainability of the Road Accident Fund. The first is to try to get to a situation where you've got direct payments to individuals. But the second is where you could limit the liability. The legislative changes that have taken place this year enable the first to be done, but that is now caught up in court. But the legislative changes does not enable the second to be done, the capping of the liability. So while we think that in 2 to 3, 4 years' time, the spending trajectory would be slightly lower because we will be able to pay people directly, assuming that the state wins the court case, there are still sustainability problems in the fund, especially because liability is not capped. And so the Portfolio Committee on Transport has more work to do to implement the second major recommendation of the Satchwell Commission on this matter in order to increase the sustainability of the fund going forward. I think I've covered...
That leaves, I think, one question on the adjustments, Chair. The 1.4 billion, that's one question. As an interim measure, Mr. Maria, through you, Chair, the DG of the National Treasury has been appointed onto the local organizing committee. He would say much against his will. But, you know, I'm sure that as soon as the deputy minister is appointed, that matter will be resolved. So it is a political responsible. But let me give you the assurance, he's responsible both as a person and politically, so he's okay. He's not too bad. That does leave two questions still. The first issue is the unresolved question by... FUBS. Different data sources. The real effective exchange rate is done 6 monthly and released by the Reserve Bank. And the nominal rate is one we can sort of compute off our own models and from information available. But if you had to go back and look at the nominal rate for July, I'm sure it's available somewhere. To see what the differential is.
What leads you to that? I'm going to answer the question that Mr. Lotto has. Because there is an issue. We have held the view.
Your mic, Mr.
My apologies. We've held the view that. Banking, unlike other sectors, can't be leveraged. Ownership of a bank requires capital. And in order to ensure that all of the liquidity requirements are met, capital that must be held against risk. This has been our saving grace through all of this period. The move to Basel II has been well timed and well executed in South Africa. Now, the debate we had with some participants in the Financial Sector Charter Council has been about this issue. Because initially there was a broad agreement that the emphasis should be on a balance, and the balance must include a series of issues under access from the Mzansi accounts and so on. Other forms of access to banking services. It must include investment in areas that would be off the beaten track, and you're starting to see that come. It should include the training and development of personnel to deal with the race and gender imbalances in banking. It should also include enterprise development by contracting with small and medium enterprises, and it must include equity. But if you wanted all of those things, then the equity prescripts from the, as set out in the BEE, BBBEE Act codes and standards, you'd have to look at them and try and strike a balance, because you can't do all of these things. And we ended up with a situation that recognized 10% direct ownership and 15% indirect ownership. The indirect ownership could be subscribed through pension funds and so on and so on, and you know, workers could get involved in that. The big debate was on the 10% direct ownership. Now, and because the codes and standards say 15%. Now, it was a very difficult debate. The additional 5% would cost, I don't know, because there have been huge movements on all share prices, but it was around 125 billion rand when we were discussing it. And the point that we were raising is that you're going to take 125 billion and put it to sleep, because large it's cash up front, and a large chunk of it would be held against risk. And we haven't relented on the fact that you can't sort of finance ownership of a bank with some IOU or promissory note. It actually needs to be paid for. I don't think we've convinced everybody. We had a series of meetings, and at the last meeting with a number of participants from the Charter Council, agreement was reached that we should try and get an exemption in terms of the BBBEE Act to ensure that we will be able to maintain the Charter Council as a sector-specific charter, and we are now waiting on DTI to, because they were in the meeting and agreed, so we're waiting on them to promulgate the gazette so that we can get the exemption. I think it would be a pity if we don't get the exemption, because the gains in the financial sector charter have been very, very significant. So if we can't continue with the council, then I think it's a major setback, because it reduces the entire empowerment debate to a focus on equity, when real empowerment happens in a variety of different ways. I mean, you know, we haven't quite resolved all of the issues, and I think, Chair, honourable members would know that the criteria set out for women in management and so on were not properly resolved. But those are issues you can deal with, but you can only deal with them if you have an institution that allows us to do.
So that's the unfortunate issue. And part of what we were
saying yesterday is it would be very bad if we haven't been able to convince people that you actually need capital to be able to capitalize these financial institutions. Thanks.
Honourable Forbes wanted the real effective exchange rate. It's an index. It's an index. It was 104 in January, and it declined to just over 100 in July.
and that gives you a deadline of 3.7%.
I think Mr. Mkuni. Whilst she's looking at the page, I think Mr. Mkuni is not okay. That is your question answered? Kuben, are you in a position to respond to Mr. Mguni's question whilst they are looking at the page?
Forgive me, Madam Chair, can you just refresh my memory on the question?
On the securitization.
The page, it's 21, eh?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Can you assist so that we don't waste time? It's page 12, Ms. Fabs. 21, they've got the page. Mr. Mguni, you know you asked.
Would you restate your question?
Mr. Mguni?
Actually, it's a follow-up on Mr. Mlot, that what about the things that are not on the bank balance sheet, and then I made mention of the securitization, which is not on the balance sheet, because banks, they still want to clean their books, and they take them off their balance sheet. They securitize them. Now, how does that pose a risk to the current economic meltdown?
I guess that is exactly why we are in this mess now. How the banks take these things off their balance sheet was that they securitize them and they will put them in a special purpose vehicle. And when they put them in this special purpose vehicle, then they are having a separate rating of their own. Now, as the accounting rules stand now, they do not have to put them on balance sheet. So what they do is that they put them in a special purpose vehicle. Basically, they have sold them to this special purpose vehicle. They get the cash, and then they can go and lend, generate more loans. So you will find that in the securitization language, depending on the company, for argument's sake, so they will have SPV1, Special Purpose Vehicle 1. So they have put that bunch of loans there, and they package it, sell it to investors. They get cash. They take that cash, they go and generate more loans, and once they have generated the loans, they create Special Purpose Vehicle 2, and they sell that to investors. So this man just does the rounds like that, and because they do not carry the thing on their balance sheets still look good. But we know that as they create this stuff, the pressure is on going to get more and more loans. And in the country land like the U.S., what then ended up happening was that the pressure to generate loans made them to lend to people with no incomes and no jobs. And as it so happened, the banks didn't even have to go and originate the loans. There was another group of completely different people called mortgage originators. So The mortgage originators will say, don't worry, I will fill the form for you. And they would do this stuff. So there was a breakdown of control and lack of supervision. The situation in South Africa became different because we were a couple of steps ahead with the National Credit Act. So you can't just go and extend these loans without checking the ability of the person to service the loans. The Registrar of Banks also controls securitization by the banks very tightly. In South Africa, there are securitization guidelines, and they are issued as part of the regulations in terms of the Banks Act. So that is what had cushioned South Africa against the this financial madness that you were seeing taking place. However, there might be others who felt that because the environment here is too restrictive and they got too clever and thought that uncreditworthy American borrowers or UK borrowers are a cool thing to invest in, and they did, and they bent their fingers. I mean, this thing spread. I mean, the Chinese discovered that their banks had done the same thing. They didn't generate the loans. They bought the one packaged in the U.S. So this thing spread across the globe like that, and it became like a contagion. And that is why you find people having governments being under pressure to bail out their banks, and some instances even an insurance company in the case of the U.S. What no one asks, because there's some excitement, it's like, what do we call this? Do you call this thing a socialist market economy, or do you call it market socialism? And there is a lot of excitement about the thing, things like, well, this thing now is taking place. What nobody asks is, how are governments going to fund all of this stuff? So what then happens is that governments end up having to sell bonds. Ireland, which was the start of
former securitized.
Ireland, which was a star performer in the European Union, they had run surpluses for 8 years in a row, had just announced that they will not be able to meet the Maastricht criteria because they had to go and bail out their banks, and they are moving into a deficit of 6% of GDP. And that would mean that the Irish fiscal authorities are going to go through a long, painful process of fiscal adjustments. Just in conclusion, Chair, closer home, is that when the financial sector charter, the negotiation of the financial sector charter, there is an amount in there of 42 billion rands for housing. And the proposal of how this thing was going to be accessed was that the banks would generate, they would securitize, or everybody else would buy, and everybody else said, wait, what are the risks here? And the bank said, well, the risks can be taken care of. All that you need is for government to guarantee this thing to the extent of 93%, and we pick up the difference. We would be having our own subprime if we decided to go that route.
Yeah, you know, the three of you fall short of one small thing, to say that that was the invisible hand of the market, and it has put the world where it is now. The invisible hand. I don't want us to continue with questions, but just for part course, is the reason given by Home Affairs for the 18.7 million for Hannes, is it the reason they gave you, or does the reason come from National Treasury?
Hannes,
Home Affairs. Yeah. Because they say that it's as a result of exchange rate fluctuations.
It's true, the exchange rate was slightly stronger than they'd budgeted for in 2007-08, and so there was a small saving on that amount.
So the reason comes from them. You know, what I'm interested in is, I know the processes that have been taking place between them and the portfolio committee about the 18.7 million. That's why I'm asking, is it the reason you got from them or what?
Yes, ma'am, it's the reason we got from them.
Okay. It's verified. Yeah, it's verified. Yeah. I've closed questions on this one. On the adjustments, I've closed questions.
Which one?
The smaller one. And just 10 seconds. Yeah. 10 seconds.
Yes, thank you, Chair. It's the question of the hedging and the derivatives. I was just hoping that Treasury by now was issuing some kind of note to departments, and if not departments, to Danel, to tell them this hedging on derivatives is a dangerous move. You know, they continue to hedge, they continue to just forget what's happening in the world today. What are we doing to caution our departments against going in that particular way?
Chair, let me just say that one of the issues that we actually have to take a fresh hard look at is the operations of all of the SOEs and the accumulation of liabilities. I think that it's very clear that we need a center that will check and verify the contractual obligations and all of those kinds of things. That must be strengthened. It's very clear to me from looking at governments everywhere and trying to understand some of the issues that are taking place here, that this is something that we really must do. It's there but not strong enough, and the terms of the PFMA don't apply, and departments, I can't tell you, departments resist. You know, Treasury is always a big ugly ogre. You must get it out of the way, you must be able to bypass it. Because it's a safeguard. I mean, much of the debate over the next few weeks will be about how bad the Treasury is. We wanted to do all these things. We didn't have plans, but we wanted to do all of these things, and the Treasury just didn't want us to do it. It's the same with some of the SOEs and the accumulation of liabilities. It's a risk not to the individuals, because it's not owned by them, it's owned by all of us. And therefore, the structure of the PFMA and hopefully its successor in title will come before this committee early in the new term. Must look at this and ensure that we have the wherewithal to deal with these matters, because these are effectively subsidiaries on our balance sheet that have to be accounted for in one way, and that is the way we understand it to happen.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Co-Chair. We've reached a stage where we actually, on the adjustments appropriation, need to take a decision in the committee. And that is why she's bringing it back to me. Because we need to take a decision on this one. And we take this decision fully aware that matters have not been fully canvassed, because as members raised some of these issues at times, and I heard when Kuben was responding, he indicated that the fuller answer would be obtained from the Department of Public Enterprises. Normally the process is that when we get to that stage, we actually call that department together with National Treasury so that we get to the truth and nothing but the truth. The total exposure Ms. Fabs was talking about with regards to Danel and the guarantees that have been called up, we had a session where we had to pass special adjustments last year, where 222 million was given. We again today and in the eyes of the committee, it's like we're just signing out checks, and you know, we're not too sure what is the total exposure. So the decision we take in the interest of the nation, because we would want this to proceed. And like Ms. Mabe was asking, whether the answer that National Treasury is giving us is the answer that came from Home Affairs, or it is a good answer that comes from National Treasury and confirmed. I mean, all those things, it helps when we reach this stage to be able to, before it is adopted by the committee, that we get those answers. But there is general agreement amongst all of us. We consulted. All members have agreed that there is no way we could stall this in the interest of, the South African public. We would have, because it's coming up for debate tomorrow in the House. And if we delay it beyond that, we would be delaying even more, things that would have gone to deserving departments and fellow citizens. So in that spirit, I would want us, with regards to the adjustments estimate, to conclude it properly by adopting the adjustments appropriation bill. Are there any objections to the appropriations bill being adopted? What was it? And I would like to then read the report of the Portfolio Committee. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Adjustments Appropriation Bill 76 of 2008, referred to it and classified by the Joint Tagging Mechanism as a money bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. Agreed. Well, I'd like to hear voices from this side. Thank you. So it is agreed to, and Mr. Asiya also indicated that had this piece of legislation that is coming on Thursday passed, this was an opportunity to test it. But unfortunately, this comes before it. So we close the first chapter, the one on adjustments appropriation. Members, we have quite a number of other things to deal with. The next one is going to be the ESCOM matter. What is it called? It's the ESCOM subordinated
loan special.
Yes. Let's go to that one. A quick. Sorry, ma'am. Yeah. Yes. Who's going to take us through? Good afternoon.
I should introduce Mr. Fuzile Che.
Okay.
He's the acting DDG of the Asset and Liability Division. It might sound like we're running Bollywood because I said Mr. Brown is acting, and now I'm saying Mr. Fuzile is acting. But, we have to formalize the process. The former DDG of this division is at the Land Bank in an acting capacity, and those issues must be resolved because he's on secondment at the moment. But Mr. Fuzile is acting in that capacity. Now he's run away. Are you going to do the presentation? There's a very brief presentation, and I'd like to ask Mr. Fuzile to be brief. It's very difficult because he comes from Kanduli, but he's going to try.
Minister and Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, for once, I'm going to disappoint the minister because I'm going to be very brief. I'm praying that technology doesn't work so that I can go through this very fast from my head. What we have before us is a bill that proposes
that the amount that the Minister of Finance announced during the tabling of the budget of 60 billion, which at the time government had undertaken to make available to Eskom over 5 years, should now, given the circumstances, be made available to Eskom over 3 years instead, in total amounts of 10 billion, 30 billion, and 20 billion. The background to this, I don't need to remind the members of, because it arises from the situation that Eskom faces, which hit the country starting at the beginning of this year. Why then government has had to support Eskom with this amount? It is because the build program that Eskom has to embark on, the first part of which is going to be over the next 5 years, amounts to 343 billion, which is an amount so huge that if Eskom were to carry it on its own balance sheet or in the strength of its own balance sheet, it would collapse under it. And of course we know, as a matter of fact, that it is precisely because of the concerns that some agency, or at least one agency, downgraded the corporate credit rating of Eskom. So to prevent further downgrading and to ensure that Eskom can access capital markets, government has then decided to assist a little bit by this, in fact not a little bit, I mean 60 billion is a lot of money, with the 60 billion and front loaded. But in addition to that, there is a commitment to assist Eskom with a guarantee should they apply for one of which they have. That is intended to enable them to borrow and also borrow at lower cost the remainder of the amount that they are not going to be able to raise through the revenue that they will get. A few details about the loan, to the extent that they matter. Eskom will not be required to pay any amount over the 10 years, first 10 years of the loan. And after 10 years, they will start to pay interest. Only if their financial situation meets an agreed credit metrics with them, the details of which I would spare the committee, which will be reviewed also annually to determine whether Eskom in fact can and should pay government. Then the whole amount would be redeemed as a bullet amount in 30 years. The cost that Eskom will pay on the loan is linked to a comparable government bond, the R209, without getting into the big breakdown, which confuses even me sometimes. Currently, we would estimate that that would amount to 9.4%, which in the current market circumstances, I'm sure you would understand, is almost free money. So the idea of the loan then was to make sure that in assessing Eskom's balance sheet and therefore its credit rating, the loan would be taken as capital, and indeed the credit rating agencies have accepted the spirit of that loan, because it does prop up the balance sheet of Eskom. Now, what is unique about the bill, which probably Parliament needs to note, is the fact that the 60 billion it is proposed should be appropriated over 3 years, so that all uncertainty about whether, you know, next amounts would come is removed, and Eskom can get on with the business of building the power stations to double its capacity by 2025. I think that covers.
Okay.
And what did you say is the extent of the guarantee? And what is the guarantee? What did you say is the amount?
The bill is not about the guarantee. I was just mentioning that additional support that would be made available to ESCOM. But the amount that the bill proposes to be appropriated is 60 billion.
Okay.
Over 3 years, 2030, 10, 30, 20.
Okay. Members, questions, if there are any? Ms. Fabs, Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to check. I had gone through this. I'm sorry, I was just out when you went through the presentation. But with respect to this, the cost, we have here on one of the slides that this has been estimated at 343 billion. And then at another point in time, it indicates perhaps why it is currently standing at 60 billion. Perhaps one of the reasons given here is that the fiscal framework limits cash support to that particular amount. Now, am I correct in that understanding, just looking at the two slides? And if that is the case, would that fiscal framework cap apply to the next 2 or 3 years? Because we did hear something somewhat differently, perhaps earlier, that this amount of 60 billion won't remain the same per se, because it certainly looks as if it is going to require more funding, as already indicated much earlier than the 60 billion itself.
Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. ESCOM will only have to pay the interest if they are in a sound financial position, and you mentioned that there are certain rules that would indicate whether they're in a sound financial position or not. But the rest of the loan then, i.e. not the interest portion, when will they start paying that back? And will that also be have a caveat on it? And then also, to just follow on with what Ms. Fubb said, is that it's clear that they will require more money and that there is a guarantee out there. I think it is very important for us to know how big that guarantee is, because that's how much government is in it for. Thanks, Chair.
Member Sheikh.
Thank you, Chairperson. I might not be understanding this, but I would like to know how much the amount that will actually, the percentage that will go to the personnel as a whole, because you might find that at the end of the day a lot of money will be going to personnel. Thank you.
Thank you, that's the lot.
ESCOM needs 343 billion to fund the part that's going to be implemented over the next 5 years. And of that, government is committing, if Parliament passes this bill, 60 billion. Now that 60 billion, if Parliament appropriates it and makes it a law, whenever, becomes the law that stands for the part that's going to be covered in the 5 years of the build program. Remember, it was first 60 billion over 5 years. But now to assist ESCOM, a bit of it, in fact all of it, has been like brought forward to the 3 years. Precisely because it acknowledges that ESCOM needs more cash sooner than originally thought. And that's what it is. Nothing more, nothing less. Now, the other part of it, which probably ESCOM would be better able to answer, but we all know they were given a 27.5 increase in their price. A substantial part of that goes into, it was in fact justified on the basis of the fact that it's going to fund part of this. They are going to apply again this year for another 3-year price determination. It will, of course, cover the requirement, taking into account, of course, a whole range of things that have changed. But in addition to that, they are going to borrow. That's why I'm saying they are going to be better able to answer certain parts of that. But for what it's worth, we are aware that negotiations between them and the African Development Bank are far advanced. Letter of no objection is in the process of being considered by the two ministers, Minister of Finance and the Minister of Public Enterprises, which will go to the African Development Bank, but they've gone quite far. Similarly, they are in discussions with the other international finance institutions, such as the World Bank, to look at other options or possibilities of sourcing funding. Thirdly, we also know, as a matter of fact, that they have had interactions with export credit agencies in the countries from which they will be buying components of what they will be using to build these stations. So that, but I can't give a breakdown of those things because it's in, you know, up to them, and some of it is probably could change depending on market conditions and so on and so forth. Now, that also deals with the more funding, because I've indicated the 60 billion, that's it. The conditions that apply to the capital sum, I thought I had mentioned this, but maybe I didn't. It's 60 billion payable on year 30. And there aren't other conditions. The conditions that are applicable to interest about ESCOM's financial situation and so on and so forth don't apply to the capital sum. And if you just step back and think about it, by year 30, if the build program has happened, everyone will probably be wanting to lend to ESCOM. Because, you know, at some point, a couple of these power stations would have kicked in, they would be generating so much cash that, you know, I don't anticipate any problems with that. The amount that would go to personnel, from what I understand, this is money to be used to buy, call it bricks and mortar if it was, but I suppose there would be steel as well and other things. It's not money that's meant to help ESCOM fund its operations, as in personnel and staff. I mean, I hope I understood the question well.
Did you?
There was the issue of the guarantees. We can't say how much, because we consider the guarantees on the basis of application. And the fact that you have applied for a guarantee does not mean you are going to get it. It means that you must approach, and there is a team of very mean fellows in the Treasury called the Guarantee Certification Committee. They ask lots of very difficult questions. If you would like to know, the next time Mr. Khadebe appears here speaking on the land bank issues, he has just been subjected to the same medicine last week, after he used to chair the Guarantee Certification Committee, and he was subjected to that same medicine last week. It gives you an idea. They seem to have forgotten that he used to chair that committee. Or maybe they were being mean because they knew that he used to be tough on all of these people. As part of the budget documentation, table 9 of the budget review, we publish all the guarantees and what gets drawn what has been drawn on each one of those years. So there is an additional oversight if members would like to track what is actually happening with those guarantees. The thing is also that because we charge fees on these guarantees, ESCOM would not approach us for argument's sake. Let's say they want guarantees of 100 billion. They will not come there and ask for all the 100 billion at the same time, because that would mean they pay guarantee fees before they get to the drawdown. So as they go out and borrow, they would approach the Treasury and say, can you guarantee this portion? And that is when the guarantee fees would actually kick in. And this is meant to
to discourage them and other SOEs from constantly seeking guarantees. And I think that that's too close to say that actually ESCOM is a very strong company. The reason why we ended up having to front load this stuff is that there is a cash mismatch in the period that during the build period. Thank you.
Okay. Further question, and that is why you didn't even bother to build in the default clause, because you don't. Okay. No. Let's go. SAA must have a default clause. Okay. Ms. Mokot, I want to move on. We're still left with 7 more items.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to check on the adjustment estimate, the presentation. You mentioned that there has been adjustments on the basis of inflation. Have you done that with the allocation to ESCOM?
Response.
No. That is why you said the 60 billion was announced at the time of the budget, honourable member. And what this does is to draw Parliament's attention and request to approve that it will be now brought forward 3 years, and it is 60 billion still, but. Surely, and this is what the Electricity Regulation Act provides for, that when the cost of doing business for ESCOM rise, therefore the price that NERSA grants to ESCOM should respond to the need for ESCOM to meet its funding commitments. And therefore, in large part, the expectation is that for ESCOM, in fact, already the price that was granted did take into account that the cost of primary energy had risen. And they will capture that, I would presume, again when they apply in future in terms of their resources. You must bear in mind this is the loan. They will pay it back, nevertheless, so that it does not have to respond necessarily to the cost of inflation. But.
Chair, I don't want to belabor the point, but wish to remind members that in ESCOM's history of almost a century, there was only one time when they had a loan from government, because it's been a self-funded entity. And that loan was for the acquisition of a power station on the Zambezi. But you know, it has been a self-funding entity, so we don't have a relationship whereby we're expected to make fiscal transfers to ESCOM. In the past 14 years, there have been transfers in order to get ESCOM to electrify households in areas that had not been electrified, but that's not a capital sum, and it's not an operational sum either. It was a special vehicle that was designed to facilitate the electrification. What we're dealing with here are two extraordinary issues. The one is that we don't run a bank. As government, we don't run a bank, so to give a loan, it's not something that we can do in the course of events through the PFMA, which is why this is a special appropriation, because Parliament must know and set the terms, or agree with the terms. And the other is that it's a capital injection into a state-owned enterprise that has not had a history of receiving transfers from the FISC. So those are the two extraordinary circumstances, and that's why this legislation has been prepared. The ability of ESCOM to raise all of its financing requirements from the markets may impact very negatively, and so the 60 billion rand would of course assist in just lowering the cost of borrowing, which would be quite important for the determination of the electricity price into the future. I mean, apart from what Mr. Fuzile so ably set out, I just wanted to give the context as to why we are at this point with this draft bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And as is traditional with legislation, now I put the bill before the committee. It's got two clauses. Yeah, it's got two clauses. The bill is before members, eh? Yeah. Has anybody got anything on clause one? If none, agreed to. Clause two is the short title. Has anybody got anything with clause two? If not, they say that the short title is too short. Okay. Okay, I now read the report. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the ESCOM Subordinated Loan Special Appropriation Bill 2008/09 to 2010/10 financial years, Bill 77 of 2008, National Assembly Section 77, referred to it and classified by the Joint Checking Mechanism as a money bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. Agreed? Thank you. Takes us to the next item on the agenda.
Chair, if I may, and I don't necessarily want to take up the time of the committee, the condemnation of interrupted service bill arises because this matter came to the committee on private members' motions as a special pleading. Parliament had supported it. It went to the Speaker. One of the difficulties was that we were never called to engage with this matter, and I remain of the view that if private members' motions are to incur financial obligations, then it actually is necessary that the Ministry of Finance be advised that we can engage with these issues, partly because some rule changes like this have enormous precedent-creating possibilities. But now the matter is before us. I'm sure that members of the committee are fully familiar with the circumstances surrounding this Kilimanjaro issue. But if not, I'm happy to answer any of the questions. Thank you.
Okay. Now, the committee had been briefed on pardon? Yeah. And that is why we had given it a ghost's name, because I don't think members would want us to spend time on this one. It's an instruction by Parliament, and as the Minister says, I think it's important that these matters be dealt with differently to how they're dealt with. But as it stands, Mr. Mlotlhi.
I was just raising one issue that maybe it should accompany our report to Parliament, that in future, when this type of issues are dealt with, we are consulted as the Portfolio Committee on Finance, because we are just rubber-stamping something that we might have very, very different views to it. Because, like the Minister has indicated, it has got some serious implication for the pension dispensation of others. So I think it would be important that the matter should be raised with Parliament, that that specific committee should consult us before they come to this type of conclusion.
Okay, that goes into our report. And I'll read the report also on this one. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Government Employees Pension Fund condonation of interrupted services Bill 79 of 2008, National Assembly Section 77, referred to it and classified by the JTM as a money bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. Agreed. Thank you. We move on to the next one. The next one is the finance bill.
Also refer and inform Judge Musanege that we work even during lunch.
And unfortunately, we report to Parliament, we don't report to the judge. Kuben, I see you've just taken a seat. You want to speak to the finance bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've just got one slide to go through. It's the last slide on the MTBPS presentation, if members are looking for it. Mr. Chair, again, this is an issue that Parliament is familiar with. Section 34(1)(a) and (b) make provision for spending that was previously declared unauthorized or irregular to be regularized by Parliament. Section 34(1)(a) provides for spending that was when a department previously overspent. The Parliament can regularize that, and Section 34(1)(b) whether the spending was unauthorized. And so we've got two clauses in this bill, or two schedules rather, I should say. Schedule 1 is for 32.2 million rand that was unauthorized due to over expenditure on the vote of the Department of Trade and Industry in 2003 and 2004. And say Schedule 2 is for 439.1 million rand that was unauthorized expenditure on the programs in the Presidency, Department of Foreign Affairs, Land Affairs, Justice and Constitutional Development and Public Works. 6 million rand was deviations from tender procedures in the Department of Justice. Both of these schedules, we tabled this bill on the recommendation of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts. In both cases, the Standing Committee on Public Accounts reports, and as you will see, the schedules to the bill detail in which report SCOPA recommends that these amounts be regularized. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. And as members would know, these reports have come before Parliament, and SCOPA has presented them to Parliament, and... Yeah, that's big English. I don't know whether it's English, but my English is my 11th language. Okay. Again, let's quickly look at the bill. The bill has also got four clauses. Anything in clause 1? It's before members. Anything in 2? And 3? And 4 is the short title. I therefore read the report. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Finance Bill, Bill 78 of 2008, National Assembly Section 77, referred to it and classified by the Joint Tagging Mechanism as a money bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. And goes.
Mr. Chair, just on this bill, I mean, this is the first time that we have had insight and motivation on this, and still, I mean, I don't know what the arguments and the real facts was at that stage. So, you know, while we were probably supported, I must just indicate that at this stage I want to acquaint myself further with some information, and I will liaise with some of the people from SCOPA on this too. just to affirm ourselves for that. Thank you.
Also go back to Parliament's minutes and check whether there were any objections in Parliament when SCOPA tabled them, because they were all tabled in Parliament. And that's the only time this bill is put together. That's how it works. Thank you.
Chair, just for the record, we come here as the postmen. I can't say post people, it's just we're gender insensitive here, but we come here as a postman, we just deliver it from SCOPA through Cabinet.
And we also do that on behalf of, when SCOPA has done that, because it's a money bill. We do exactly like you do. What's next on the list? My goodness. No. If you don't get much. Aninda. No. There's no lunch. It's Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. There's no lunch. Bill 80. Members, we had gone through this bill. Who's responsible for? Look, members, we had gone through this. We had basically agreed to the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. All we were left with was the formal consideration of the bill. We did this on Monday the 20th, not very long ago. Yeah. And today is only the 22nd. So, I mean, I can't see why we might have, might want to go back to what we discussed on Monday. The report reads as follows. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill, Bill 80 of 2008 National Assembly, Section 77, referred to it and classified by the joint tagging mechanism as a money bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. Agreed. Thank you. You know, there is a very, very long motion on the motion of desirability, which I actually should have started with on the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. No, it's the second one. Yeah. No, it's the second amendment bill, the Revenue Laws Second Amendment Bill. Motion of desirability. That in the opinion of the committee, legislation is desirable. To do all the listed things on the motion of desirability. If members want to have an insight to it, I'll make copies available to members. It's as you see on the bill, your it's there. Okay. I therefore read the report. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Revenue Laws Second Amendment Bill, Bill 81 of 2008, National Assembly, Section 75, referred to it and classified by the joint checking mechanism as a Section 75 bill, reports the bill without amendments. Agreed? What else?
Look,
honourable members, I'm so disappointed that we have finished so early. You know, I was looking forward to a meeting until 1 o'clock. Mr. Marek.
Mr. Chair, can I just mention one thing? We know that we have received our schedules in terms of debates for tomorrow, and quite strangely, we have received notice that the debate on the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill has been shortened. And if I look at the allocation of times, it's actually ridiculous to have time available on the other two bills that we have just handled, and that the debating time on the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill has shortened to such a nature that it actually defeats the object of debate on this bill. So it's just one concern I want to raise, and I don't know how serious the whips are in terms of this, if they had agreed to that.
Question directed to the whips. Unfortunately,
Chair, Mr. Marais says that they've given him 15 seconds.
No, unfortunately, I really sympathize with you. I don't know. If you look at the program tomorrow, in fact, you said that it was cut on my minutes, I'll be quite happy. All these debates coming before the committee tomorrow, and in the evening. And I think by the time we get to that, you know,